This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, so let's jump right into the week in review, starting with the legal and political upheaval caused by the unexpected death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Here's Ronald Cass, Dean Emeritus of BU's Law School, who knew Scalia for almost 40 years.
He was someone who believed deeply in being governed by law, not being governed by will. And anything we do, whether as judges or scholars, should be respectful of the process and what it means to be governed by law.
However, it's politics that's currently ruling at the moment, and the full-throated battle between President Obama and members of the Republican Party over whether Obama should or should not nominate a new justice.
There's no unwritten law that says that it can only be done on off years. That's not in the constitutional text. I'm amused when I hear people who claim to be strict interpreters of the Constitution suddenly reading into it a whole series of provisions that are not there.
I think he's going to do it, whether I'm okay with it or not. I think it's up to Mitch McConnell and everybody else to stop it. It's called delay, delay, delay.
Well, we're joined now in the studio by Judge Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and now professor at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
You're as close as we could get to the Supreme Court today.
I'm waiting for the call.
I'm sure it may come any day now.
Right.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, great to see you again.
Good to be with you.
All right, so Judge Gertner, let's just start with you. Your first thoughts on Scalia himself and his legacy on the High Court.
I think that he is a there was no question that he provided the voice for conservatism on the court. And he provided an intellectual rationale for conservatism, which was originalism.
Textualism, as he liked to call it.
There were certainly ways in which his principled stand on the original intent of the Constitution led to results which I'm sure he didn't believe in personally, and that's sort of a quintessential judge moment, right, where you are following principle and you lead to a result that you go, well, I don't think this is right, but the law leads me there. And that was principally, interestingly, often criminal law and criminal procedure issues. On the other hand, originalism, textualism has an apparent certainty and a reality that is totally different. Mm. The original intent of the Constitution was complicated. In fact, people who write about the ratification process say that people who walked away from the drafting had very different ideas about what the document was about. And in addition, the drafters were white, male, property, blacks were chattel.
Slave owners.
Right. And women were not voting members. So the original intent of a document that certainly governs us, but has to be seen in the context of the time, mm-hmm. which is not what he did.
Mm. Well, we're going to talk about the political implications of his death in just a second. But Jim, I wanted to get your thoughts on Scalia's high court legacy.
No, look, I'm not going to follow up the judge and try to, you know, give a more nuanced view of Scalia. What I would say is I think one of the things I take away from him is he understood also the weaknesses of the Constitution. He himself talking about, were it possible to change the amendment process to make it a process that would allow for maybe more frequent amending? That is something he saw, the fact that 2% of the population could block any kind of amendment as a problem, especially when you're trying to follow a written document, mm-hmm. right? To the judge's point, we have changed the country a lot, and you want some participation. I mean, no one thinks these days about an amendment to the Constitution unless they're really crazy and want to dedicate 40 years to it. So there's a lot more to him, I think, than most people have read in public, and he's an interesting figure.
Yeah, so, you know, in the immediate aftermath of Scalia's death, there, of course, was a lot of respectful looking back on his legacy, his opinions, both in the majority and in the dissent. He was often at his most potent in writing in dissent. But then, you know, a few days later, I started noting that, especially amongst sort of more liberal observers of the High Court, there started to be those other voices of I don't know, caution's not the right word, but skepticism in terms of, you know, looking back and saying, I'm thinking of Linda Greenhouse in the New York Times,
yes.
Right? She wrote that, you know, the court, the justices don't want the court to be a political institution, and yet politics surrounds it. And she said that she pointed to aspects of Scalia's legacy where she said, in a way, Antonin Scalia was one of the justices who helped politicize the court. I mean, Judge Gertner, is that fair?
Well, I mean, she made a very interesting point. She said that his dissents were certainly not written for the rest of the court. And then some people have said, and I think O'Connor, some people have described O'Connor as actually moving to the middle in reaction to the vituperation of Scalia's dissent. So they were not written for the rest of the court. They were written for law students. And in that sense, political isn't written for law students and written for political movements. Writing for law students is not a troubling because you're talking about legal philosophy. Writing purple prose for the public, that's a different issue.
I mean, she went so far as to say that there were times where he would write, in particular in dissents, on issues that weren't even or questions that weren't even the matter of the case at hand on the court, and
right.
That's what troubled her.
And she talked about the numbers of times the court has recently, for example, taken in Obama's environmental regulations, even when no court has passed.
But there's still
them.
A review going on
that's
in a lower
right.
court.
That's right. Yeah. So I mean, there and that's inconsistent. Originalism is to some degree a judicial restraint philosophy, and so all of the things that she cited are inconsistent with judicial restraint.
Hmm. So let's turn now to the political maelstrom that we find ourselves in regarding this moment. We heard a tape a little earlier from both President Barack Obama and Donald Trump about whether or not
that great constitutional scholar, Donald Trump. I'm sorry.
But Jim, let me just get your thoughts here. First of all, what do you make of the fact that it's inevitable that there's a major brouhaha going on right now, but what's your reaction to it?
I guess I'd make probably 2 points. One is that I stand with Alexander Hamilton, probably not in his desire for a muscular federal government. I'm probably not aligned with that.
Mm-hmm.
But his view that the court is the weakest branch. I don't think the fate of the republic lies in the selection of one individual. And if it does, we are truly troubled as a republic. The second thing I note is, look, anybody who says that the president can't nominate someone and his nominee should not be under consideration is making a ridiculous statement. The Constitution is very clear on it. What I would say is anybody who says that the Senate should simply go ahead with the nomination and move it forward, I think knows nothing about history. I mean, we could go through the founding era, John Adams' appointment of John Marshall. You could go to FDR's court packing, go to the 1960 Democratic Party revolt against President Eisenhower, not a greatly transformative president, not very controversial. They would not allow his Supreme Court nominees to go forward in his last year. Bork, Thomas, mm-hmm. Abe Fortas. I mean, we've seen this movie many, many times. What I would say is if the Senate is perceived by the public as taking this out of the bounds of what is appropriate, they could pay at the ballot box. And that's the place of ultimate accountability.
Okay, so before I get to you, Judge Gertner, let's just get a little bit more of some tape in from the week that sort of gives us a sense of the zeitgeist of the moment regarding politics. Here's Texas Senator and Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos talking about this question of nominating a new justice.
Does that mean that you're going to filibuster anyone that President Obama nominates?
Absolutely. This should be a decision for the people, George. Let the election decide. If the Democrats want to replace this nominee, they need to win the election.
Okay, so perhaps expected heated rhetoric from Ted Cruz there. On the other hand, this is a battle going on again within the Republican Party because we have Judiciary Committee Chairman Senator Chuck Grassley seeming to leave the door open on holding hearings on an Obama nominee if and when that comes. Here he is talking to IO reporters on Tuesday.
I would wait until the nominee is made before I would make any decisions. In other words, take it a step at a time, but I think you need to know that I have made a statement that this is a very serious position to fill.
Nancy Gertner, your thoughts.
Well, step back a moment. If Obama nominated a moderate, an Anthony Kennedy, or even someone to the right of Anthony Kennedy, a moderate in the court's middle, it would change the court. And arguably, in other time periods in our history, a moderate was precisely what people were aiming for the court.
Hmm.
So that to some degree, the subtext here is that the Republicans want a Scalia on the court. And interestingly enough, I think that Obama is going to go for very, very much the moderate on the court. It's also, you have to put this obstructionism in context. You know, to some degree, the confirmation of courts of appeals judges and district court judges have stopped in this Congress, at least by mid-December, which was unheard of in previous administrations. And one final point, there is something supremely disrespectful to this African-American president to say, we won't even consider what you're doing. I can't imagine that being said to any other president.
Mm. Jim, did you have a thought? Because I've got a couple more legal questions for the judge, but I want to get you
back. I don't think race comes into this whatsoever. I think this is a pure battle over political power. And part of the problem is you were asking a question before, Magna, about the politicization of our court. Mm. And it is, I think, in large part because we push more and more political questions toward the court because we're so uncivilized and unable to have real conversations in the House of Representatives, in the public, about issues we should be talking about, that we push a lot of political questions toward the court that will inevitably make it political. I mean, you saw this scene when John Roberts on the Affordable Care Act. I mean, he was writhing every which way to make sure the court didn't get pulled out as an institution that was explicitly political.
Right.
That's a very hard place to be.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many examples. The one that my mind keeps going back to is Bush v. Gore back in 2000. But, I mean, so this week we heard people talking about, you know, constitutional crisis, et cetera, which I have to say I fully don't buy into 100% here, Judge Gertner. But my last question before we move on is, say, for example, I don't think this is going to happen, but, like, you know, hypothetically speaking, what if either President Obama didn't put forth a nominee or the Senate decided to not consider the nominee? We could be facing a situation where there are many, many months in which it's a 4-4 court. I mean, what would be the long-term implications of that?
Well, the long-term implications would be that the lower court decisions, which are a patchwork quilt in some areas, would stand because the court couldn't resolve them. The 4-4 split the odds are that the court would stop taking some of the cases that Jim is talking about precisely because they can't resolve them. And if you are waiting for the next president, so you're talking, I think, about at least a year and a half of a 4-4 split. If a Republican wins, for example, and wants to replace Scalia with a Scalia-esque character, there will be a fight. So we are talking, I don't know about constitutional crisis, but you are talking about paralysis in the Supreme Court for a long time. Just get back to what Jim said about the racism issue. Any other time, you would have had what Grassley said, which is, we'll consider whatever you say, Mr. President, and then, of course, no one passes muster. What for me is the disrespectful part is to say to the president, you may not propose a nominee. Mm. I can't imagine that being said.
That happened again in 1960 to Eisenhower, where there was a resolution that was passed by the Senate saying they would not consider any of his appointments. Now, and again, he was not someone who said terribly controversial things. The thing is, the Democrats knew they had a very good chance of winning the presidency. Mm-hmm. So, again, I think history is just filled with this sort of thing. So I think we should disrespect politics enough to say that we want a little bit less of it around this process, and the rest of the stuff we can kind of set aside, I hope.
Hear, hear, Jim Sturgis. All right, well, let's move on now to a story that's much closer to home and ostensibly has a lot more impact immediately on people here in Massachusetts, and that, of course, has to do with, here's a big sigh, transportation, because yesterday there was another hellish commute on the commuter rail after a broken Amtrak signal kept commuter rail trains out of South Station. This morning, the T announced the problem had been fixed, but here's Scott Moore. He works in Cambridge, lives in Franklin, and he tried to get home on the commuter rail last night, but he told WBUR that he's oh so frustrated with the MBTA.
Man, I mean, the weather's not even bad, right? Mm-hmm. The weather's gorgeous, and we're still having this trouble, so it, of course, would be better if it was we didn't have these kind of days when, again, you can't blame the weather.
Is your patience running thin?
It's getting there, yeah.
And earlier this week, a panel fell off an Orange Line train, and another train then hit the panel, I believe, causing smoke and explosive sound. Riders had to kick out windows to escape the train. Jim, I'm not even sure where to begin. Part of me feels for the T because the Amtrak signal isn't necessarily their fault, although it really had a huge impact on T riders. So what do you make of the week?
Not a good week. Look,
headline.
Look, the T says the Amtrak problem isn't they say it's an anomaly. The fact is, anybody who knows the Providence line that runs through Attleboro, Stoughton line, knows that this is a frequent occurrence. And one of the things that's most maddening about it is there's an absolute lack of communication. What gets communicated to the media and what gets communicated to riders. Scott Moore should be extremely frustrated. I think people really are. And I think one of the things that this it comes at an unfortunate time. The governor wants to have a fare increase, and we're against that. You can't make the Scott Moores of the world are not going to support that sort of thing, right? And it's kind of a shame because the T right now is actually making some huge – these are the sorts of things that no one looks at except people like me who are dweebs. I mean, they used to have year-to-year growth in their expenses of 5%, sometimes even 10% a year.
Huh.
Since the control board's come into place, it's less than 1% last data that we saw. Now, that means you're putting the T on a more sustainable basis, right? But to a rider, I don't really care about that. I want the trains to run on time.
Yeah. I don't want to have to stand on a platform with 10,000 other people not knowing when the next train is going to come. Right. Nancy Gertner, your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, one of the things that happened during the terrible winter last year was we understood the relationship between mass transit and inequality. Inequality. In other words, that there were people who couldn't just hop on a cab to go to their, waitressing job. And so the T and public transportation is essential to the participation of all classes in our city. And I think that people would feel differently about this if it didn't have a history.
Mm.
If it didn't have a history. I mean, you'd give, you know, stuff happens and you'd give... You know, you'd allow the institution to have some mistakes, but not as often and not as dramatic as these. I think that the governor should do whatever is necessary to have a world class transportation system for the city of Boston. It's a scandal that there isn't one.
Yeah. I'm with her.
can I
add just one small thing?
Please do.
Look, to add insult to injury, Keolis has put out some information saying that they have 95% on-time performance. But, of course, they define that in their own way. And if you look at peak hour performance, when people actually care about this, it's like 86%.
Yeah.
In some places, it's like 50s, 60s. We need the T to do some simple stuff like the raw data on on-time arrival. Just make it available to the public. Some smart person will from MIT, she will create an app and we'll be able to see what's happening. And if you're late, you'll look at the train and say, they're lying.
Sure.
Right? This
yeah.
is sort of accountability we kind of need to build in this system to make some change.
And as you said, it should be fairly easy to institute that accountability in this day and age.
Yeah.
All right. Before we get to our hubbubs, I do want to actually spend a minute talking about Boston Latin School because today a report from the Boston Public Schools, which was a review of the racial climate at Boston Latin after students there had made complaints regarding the fact that they said the administration failed to act on reports of racist behavior by other students. This report from Boston Public Schools said that, yes, school leadership didn't adequately investigate the claims, but that it didn't suggest any discipline for Boston Latin staff itself. So we have a little bit of tape here from Superintendent Tommy Chang. And while he wouldn't comment on any possible actions against Boston Latin leadership, Chang did say this.
I'm not going to be satisfied until every single student in Boston Latin School and in Boston Public Schools feels that they are safe at schools so they can actually learn. That's my number one priority, and we are not there. But I have absolutely strong belief that this school system can get there.
So, Jim, actually, let me just start with you, because I have to say, seeing that the Boston Public Schools have affirmed what students were saying, and they started this on a social media campaign, is quite arresting in and of itself. But do you think that there should be further action taken now?
There should have been action taken before. These kids are actually amazing. I was listening to them, their on-air appearance, just in talking to Walsh. She's a very poised kids who actually have a real grievance. The stuff that has been said on social media is appalling.
Yeah.
So why isn't it that the headmaster, as soon as this happened, didn't pull everyone together and say, look, folks, we're going to read Frederick Douglass's autobiographies, and we're going to read stuff from the abolitionists, and we're going to read all kinds of stuff around the desegregation issue here in Boston, and we'll read, you know, Lucas's book, Common Ground, and we'll read Dentler's stuff around cities and desegregation, and you're going to learn something about this. I mean, rather than having this whole conversation around who gets disciplined, focus on the kids. I mean, these kids said some pretty terrible things.
Yeah.
So that, to me, that wasn't done is astounding.
Mm. Well, Nancy Gertner, we talked to Maggie Noel and Kylie Webster Cuzzo, the two students who started raising awareness about the more than uncomfortable climate that they were facing at Boston Latin. And, you know, we also talked to the mayor about it, and he expanded the question about whether or not something needs to be done district-wide at Boston, because he doesn't want any student in any school to feel as if they're not welcome there by virtue of their race, especially in Boston, which is a majority-minority city now, to be perfectly honest. But I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on this situation as well.
Well, I mean, I agree with Jim that this is an individual problem, but there's no question about it. There are students who needed to be disciplined, but it's also an institutional problem that the school has to address as a school. And when you ask about should the headmaster have been disciplined, I mean, I think that's a larger question. You don't want people to be disciplined for one incident. I don't really know what I think about that, but it does seem to me that you have to say, how did it come to pass that this happened? How did it come to pass that people felt that they were privileged to make these kinds of comments? And what can we do about it? Which really goes to the kinds of issues that Jim was talking about. I mean, that's really where the issue is. It's so easy for us to look at comments of individual students as if it's an individual discipline issue, victim and perpetrator issue. This is really a wider question, and it has to be addressed in a wider way.
Well, I mean, to fundamentally start with the question of how is there a culture in which there must be a culture that exists here where students felt that comfortable and secure even making those kinds of statements, those racist
Maybe
statements.
There's something one of the kids said on air, which for me was important. She said, in an AP history course, I could be the only African-American sitting there. So I went and looked at the data. 9% of the kids at Boston Latin School are African-Americans, 32% across the schools. It says something about we need to create some feeder systems to get more of these kids into Boston Latin, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's going on. I would focus on that specific school incident. A whole big plan that people roll out for the entire school system, Meghna, we've seen those before.
He's shaking his head, ladies. Okay. Well, we've got just enough time now for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of the news, but are worthy of a mention nonetheless. And Jim, why don't you give us a start?
You often describe these as under-the-fold stories. Yes. This is way off the page. At a time when we're thinking about nominating a new justice to the Supreme Court, I just want to remind people of the famed jurist Learned Hand, who was scholarly. He was a Democrat, then a Republican, then a progressive. He was smarter than just about every other individual ever confirmed the court, like Nancy Gertner. He today has the legacy of being quoted favorably by Ginsburg as well as Scalia. It's a great story. There are many great stories. He could be highly sarcastic. He was also physical in his expression of a displeasure when lawyers came before him. He would turn his chair 180 degrees in the opposite direction. And one of his memorable quotes is, "This is the most miserable of cases, but we must dispose of it as though it had been presented by actual lawyers." If we could find a jurist like that, put him on the bench.
We might as well also, as a society, take his advice right now in terms of how to handle the politics of the moment. Great hubbub, Jim. Nancy, what about yours?
And this is related to that. I'm dealing with Professor Sunstein at the Harvard Law School.
Cass Sunstein.
Sunstein, who wrote a review of it's entitled "How Star Wars Illuminates Constitutional Law." And I have to admit that I am a Star Wars fan and a Trekkie, and I'm not sure I completely understand what he's talking about, but he says the "I am your father" moment in Star Wars. I'll explain that to you, Jim, in a minute.
By the way, Nancy Gertner just outed Jim Sturgis as the one human being in the world who has not yet seen Star Wars.
And it
None
says,
of them.
Right. Says that the "I am your father" moment involved pivotal transitions and reversals of course that nevertheless maintain continuity with the previous story. And that's what we see in constitutional law, where there are pivotal changes in directions which nevertheless provide continuity with the original document. So Stan Sunstein, via Star Wars, I'm not sure I made any sense whatsoever, is decrying originalism. But then again, I also know how to speak Klingon. That's a Trekkie language from Star Trek, not Star Wars. And some people believed my opinions were in fact written in the original Klingon.
Okay. And by the way, Professor Sunstein, we know your book's coming out later this spring on Star Wars. We look forward to talking to you about it then if you're listening right now. All right, so my hubbub, totally, speaking of turning 180 degrees, this is as far from the law as you can get. And it's not even Massachusetts-based, but I thought it was worth a mention because this week, Sports Illustrated actually put out three different versions of its annual swimsuit issue. Okay, in the world-famous swimsuit issue. And for the first time ever, one of the women on the cover is a full-sized, as they call it in the business, or a plus-size model. She's Ashley Graham, and she's drop-dead gorgeous. She's a size 16, which, of course, again, in the fashion industry is plus-size. But really breaking new ground here. And I just had a little bit of tape from MJ Day, who's the assistant managing editor of the SI swimsuit issue. She was speaking on the SI podcast, The Gray Area with Maggie Gray, and she was talking about how she'd wanted to do this for a long time and put more real-looking women on, or natural-looking women on the cover of the swimsuit issue, but it hadn't happened until now, et cetera, et cetera. So here she is.
In my opinion, this is very normal, and we should be doing this. And people are going to talk about it, of course, you know, but what is happening here is we're stating the obvious, you know? There's all different types of beauty, and one size does not fit all in terms of what is beautiful.
Okay, so MJ Day, hats off to you, because that is absolutely true. But I would say SI has a large role to play in terms of why it's taken so long for popular culture to accept all body shapes and sizes.
Right.
So if you face up to that, SI, then double props. But Ashley Graham, check her out. She's something to look at. Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. It's great to have you as always.
Have a great weekend.
And Nancy Gertner, former federal judge and professor at Harvard Law School. Great to have you as well.
Nice to be here.
We'll be back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.